Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, for our final show of 2016. This week we're getting all nostalgic and misty-eyed as we look back on the year that was on Culture. Over the past 12 months we've sauntered around art fairs, danced at festivals and examined prehistoric beasts at auction houses in the countryside. We've read books from exotic lands and manhandled some of the oldest manuscripts in the world. And the show has taken us to the roof of a cinema, to an art show in the basement of an office block via a cruise liner in the middle of the Met. It's been a varied year with plenty of good stuff, much of which we're going to play for you right now. So sit back as we present to you our greatest hits on Culture with me, Robert Bound. And with fanfare. It's culture producer Holly. She's in the show, ladies and gentlemen. Holly, welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Rob. Thanks
How
for having
lovely
me.
To have you this side of the glass.
Hopefully I can stay for the whole show and you're not going to send me back again.
It's quite weird. I keep thinking, I hear your voice and I'm inclined to move my head to the right and look through to the control panel.
Well, we have another lovely blonde.
We have another lovely blonde, Claire Urban. Also, we should tell listeners that we recorded this programme just before our Christmas party. So if we've sound extra jolly, the wind is in our favour, is it not? And we're all poshed up, we're all glammed up. Claire is cheersing us, Holly, through the glass.
Cheers to Claire.
So Merry Christmas, everybody. Now let's kick off with one of our highlights of London's art shows this year. This was The Infinite Mix. How good a show was this, Holly?
Oh, it was so brilliant. Yeah. We had such a good time when we went there.
It was such a joy to report on. The people we spoke to and waved microphones in the face of were a great pleasure. But also, we just massively vibed off this thing. We could have spent all day there, right?
Yeah, I could have gone back every single day.
We often are in the habit of having to kill darlings on this show. What was your favourite of the 10 rooms of The Infinite Mix, if you can remember?
Oh, I don't know. That's quite a tricky one. The one I always come back to was the one in the basement, which was called Nightlife.
And was this a Cyprian Gaillard one?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, my favourite as well.
The 3D one, and had that beautiful track playing that has been stuck in my head ever since we went back in autumn, and it was really, really fantastic.
It's beautiful,
very
stuff.
Moving. Yeah,
we concur on that, and the wonderful ghostly Maria Callas singing opera down a corridor,
kind of
like an apparition. Anyway, let's tell our listeners what it is if they don't know. The Infinite Mix was the show that adorned the walls and the hallways of a great brutalist building. It was an old office block just over the river from the Hayward Gallery's usual home, and the Hayward, by the way, had the Builders Inn at that point, which is why they'd up sticks. The show was a series of 10 audiovisual works that ranged from something like Stan Douglas's Luanda Kinshasa, a studio documentary come music film, to Cyprian Gaillard's Nightlife that we loved so much, which was a swirling, hypnotic, beautiful film, sort of a reggae loop, via Elizabeth Price's sci-fi depiction of professional mourners and a loom that weaved fluoro stockings. Now, this was visual art with wonderful audio. Ralph Rugoff, the director of the Hayward Gallery, no less, tells us about the vision behind all this sound and vision.
Shall I come out? Shit. Y'all gotta make movies and shit. This is movies.
When the lights shut off, and it's my turn to settle down, my main concern, promise that you will sing about me. Promise that you will sing.
Bam Bam is the best dancehall queen in Japan.
When I first came back to Earth after 128 days in space, I thought I had ruined my life. The weight of your body is overwhelming. Even my ears felt heavy on my head.
No, I mean, I think I could go through most of the show with my eyes closed and get a huge amount out of it. A lot of artists have actually commissioned or composed themselves the soundtracks. Other artists have done, you know, really radical remixes, like Rachel Rose took a piece of music by Aretha Franklin and used a spectroscope to erase all the instrumentation and all the words. So the only thing you get are these wordless vocalizations of this amazing voice of Aretha Franklin, which Rachel said sounded to her like a voice that had been freed from a human body. Okay, and this is in a piece about an astronaut who's talking about what it's like to have a body in gravity after you've been in space for 180 days. And again, it's in a piece where Rachel created a screen that allows you to see through the screen and out the window of the building and to look at the city. So at times you're looking at an image, at times you're seeing the city through the image. These are really unusual ways of presenting what we usually refer to as video, and what I keep trying to have to refer to as audiovisual, because the audio is just as important.
Rachel's piece up there on the top floor feels like a bit of a motif for the whole show, this idea of anti-gravity somehow that you've sort of created. Was it very obvious which pieces went where? And there must have been a lot of to-ing and fro-ing with the artists and placing these works.
Some artists came in and they really knew they wanted to put their work in a special place in the building. So Dominique Gonzalez Foster, who created this kind of holographic apparition of Maria Callas, was thrilled when we took her into, because we're actually in two buildings here. There's a glass building in the middle of the space, and then there's a bridge that takes you to this stone building, which is completely abandoned and slightly derelict. And when she saw that space, she flipped. And if you'd seen it before we got to it, you'd realize that, yeah, it's the perfect place for a ghost to appear. This is a haunted corridor. And interestingly, she said, you know, I think this space adds about 50% more to the work. So space and how artists use it, we think of that happening with sculpture, but actually with works like this, it makes a huge difference too. And Cyprian Guyard also, who's got an amazing 3D film, Nightlife, there was only one place he really seriously considered, which was this vast, cavernous car park, which when we first looked at it had, you know, water streaming from the ceiling, mice running around, totally post-apocalyptic space. But for this film of his, it's a great location. I mean, Cyprian's an artist who's fascinated by entropy, by chaos, by how things come together and fall apart. And it's a great place to end the exhibition because people then go out and find themselves on a side street, which is not the way they came in because they're exiting through the car park. And that's a nice final moment, I think, of disorientation, that you've been through this incredible journey. Artists really pushing you to look at things in ways that we're not used to looking at images. And that, of course, always leaves us disoriented, but, you know, there's no sense of discovery without first feeling a little lost. So that's, I think, what a lot of this work does for us in this show.
Okay, so that was Ralph Rogoff talking about The Infinite Mix, one of the shows of last year at the Hayward Gallery, or rather at the Hayward Gallery's extension, number 100, The Strand, I think it was.
180, I believe.
180, The Strand. Yeah. I always think of things in terms of really good darts scores since I got a dartboard for Christmas last year. I don't know why I didn't do that. I clearly need practice, Holly. So the next thing on our list is The Cruise.
Well, I think this is maybe my favourite thing that went into the magazine this year. My favourite photograph of the whole of Monocle this year was of a conga line going across a cruise ship that took up about 3/4 of a double page spread.
Yeah.
And I believe you were just off shot.
Yeah. I just artfully been cut out of that photograph. So we're redesigning the magazine. Issue 101 is going to be quite different. It's going to be our March issue. It's going to have quite a different look and feel. And one of the touchstones for the redesign of this magazine and the kind of vibe of the magazine is going to be this stupid story and this conga line photograph. There aren't enough conga lines, clearly. In 10 years of Monocle and 5 years of Monocle Radio, there haven't been enough congas. Shall we queue up that definitely? It was a story, not a holiday. Shall we queue up good old Franco Pilli, who is the cruise director of the MSC Preziosa?
The shop manager is managing all shops and boutiques on board, all of them, of course, with the best brands from around the world. Il manager che gestisce tutti I negozi e boutique a bordo, tutte con le migliori marche provenienti da tutto il mondo.
The cruise director is amongst other things also the voice of the ship. The cruise director is more one, a guy of the entertainment, the shows, you know, and that. And they chose to leave the cruise director in his civil clothes, you know, in a sober elegance, but not without the stripes. I'm not sure that's quite appropriate for a cruise director. I mean, I like to be fun on stage. And some cruise director, for example, in some other companies, they tell jokes before they, before they present the shows and so on. And, you know, if you are in a uniform, somehow you're bound to be a little bit more serious, you know what I mean?
Feel like you should be saluting rather than bowing.
Yeah, a bit more too sober, perhaps, you know. And like I have, like when I introduce the show, when I come on stage, I have this, which is has become a little bit like my brand. I do like a thing, you know, and it's fun. The people, they laugh because I cannot tell jokes. We have 65 different nationalities and so many different languages. I already speak in the five main languages here in the Mediterranean, which is English, French, Spanish, Italian, and German. So you cannot tell jokes. So what I do is the strange move, you know, and the people, they laugh. You know.
A visual joke is good. So in terms of the entertainment offering, Franco, you've got, I mean, I can't believe it. This is the first time I've been on a big cruise ship. But we've just seen a show on the main, in your main theatre here. I mean, packed out. How many seats are there? And how many entertainers do you have on board any one time, from a piano player in one of the smaller bars to one of the big shows like tonight?
Well, this theatre is really amazing. And still today, the first time I worked in a theater like this one was on the sister ship, the Splendida, and I remember, imagine my face when I saw it. It was like my own mouth open and wow, whoa. It's over 1,600 places, so 1,607 or something like that. And it's a theater equipped with a state-of-the-art technology for lights, and the stage itself moves, turns and moves up and down, and a huge sound system and so on. It's really something to be proud of. I believe that even big cities on land, they'd be fantastically happy and proud to have a theater like this. And we have a floating one carrying our audience all the time with us. So that's something. It's like a dream.
Okay, thank you very much, the MSC Preziosa, for your board and lodging and a lot of free drinks that week on that boat. It was definitely time to leave by the time we disembarked in Marseille, I have to say. Okay, so that was a good one, Holly. Green Man, this was always a very collaborative effort. It's always lots of fun. You've been going for longer than I have. What sets this wonderful green festival apart from all the others?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's one of the only medium-sized festivals in the UK that has stuck to its guns, it stayed independent, it hasn't sold out to a big umbrella company. And, you know, you can see that throughout the festival. You know, the bars are all local beers, yeah. Hundreds of local beers in particular at Green Man.
And we tried pretty much everyone.
We did very well to make a good dent in that list, I think. And, you know, they always have a stellar lineup of acts and also the best main stage of any festival in the whole of the UK. The mountain stage is sort of set in this amphitheatre against this amazing mountainous backdrop, hence its name, the mountain stage. And watching any band on there is an absolute joy.
And the people that put together, we spoke to some of the people, Fiona Stewart and her son, and then the guy that we're gonna play up in a minute is Ian Fielder, who's been putting this thing together. The technical team, the people that choose the bands that are going to come and put the whole thing together, because it's professional, but it's not tight ass, is it? It's kind of it's a tight run ship, but it feels very kind of chilled out.
Yeah, I think you have
time.
To have a bit of leeway with a festival because you never quite know what's around the corner, especially somewhere in the south of Wales that has its very own microclimate.
Yeah, exactly. It's called Green Man for a reason.
It
ain't ever been brown, right? Well, listen, Holly, let's queue up Ian Fielder, a.k.a. Noosh. He's been one of the people behind the festival. He's been running it for years and years and years. And there's all sorts of different jobs. His has always been an interesting one. He basically has all the practical know-how. He keeps things running safe and smoothly. Well, let's see. Here's Noosh.
During the festival, normally up about 6 a.m. in the morning, we go into our control room, which is downstairs of where we're living in the house in the middle of the festival site, and go and catch up with the control team who have been working all night. They sort of come onto shift at 2 in the morning and then monitor all our radio channels, especially security and stewards, and they'll give me an update of what's been going on in the evening, if there's any outstanding incidents that are ongoing.
Well, how do we rate an incident? Give me a 1 and give me a 10.
A 1 is probably something like a light bulb's gone out, or a or a tap is leaking. We've probably never got near a 10, but let me think of some of the sort of...
We'll come back to a 10. We'll have the 10 at the end. We'll save the best for last, the worst for last. And, you know, you're in charge of a big team here. People will be intrigued to know, this beautiful corner of South Wales, how soon you are setting up, how soon the kind of infrastructure gets made. Because you're basically building a city for a weekend here.
Yeah, so we get on site about 2.5 weeks before. There's nothing here when we turn up. This year, myself and Fiona and another person working from the office, Harriet, were down here and were joined by our site crew who basically build the site. So they're banging in scaffold poles all over the place, putting up signage, laying out fire lanes, all the sort of core infrastructure. And they do that before anyone else comes onto site. So all the heavy stuff like porta cabins gets delivered, things like that. And then after a week, the site electricians turn up, they start laying out cables, then our decor team turn up. We're building a lot more sort of structures and decorating the site a lot more than we used to. So we've got nearly sort of 100 people just working on decor, and they spend like 1.5-2 weeks.
One of the things that's very memorable about Green Man is its branding, its signage, its typeface, all this kind of stuff, because it's a good looking festival. It's important to show people where the loos are and where the bar is and where the main stage is, but there's a great deal of artistry involved in that as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the festival is in such a beautiful place anyway. You know, we sort of build stuff to sort of fit into the natural environment. You know, we're very lucky being here. It's a beautiful place, but, you know, we can always make it more beautiful. So we, you know, as well as a decor, we've got a load of new visual arts this year. Got really interesting light installations.
Yeah, we're going to speak to Nathaniel Rackow later, actually, who's done one of the art pieces. Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, and that's been quite interesting technically, because even though it looks quite simple, it sort of builds these big sort of cubes that sort of appear to hang in the air, illuminated cubes. But here he wanted to do it in the trees, so we were rigging the structure into trees, which obviously moving living objects. So a lot of thought went into sort of different ways to hang it, and, you know, it's quite an, for what looks like quite a simple structure, it's quite an involved process.
Basically his artistic intervention was frankly the last thing you needed in a busy week.
No, do you know what, like, you know, we've been doing festivals for a long time, and that's exactly what festival's about. It's marrying up the sort of the logistics and the practicalities with people's like creative genius, and that's sort of, you know, I guess what we see. You know, so it's my job doing sort of letting all these amazing people we work with sort of realise their artistic visions.
Your Friday night headliners last night did us proud. Do you get to stand back then at least and see almost 20,000 people in that wonderful natural amphitheatre and feel proud of
them? Yeah, absolutely. That is for me the sort of tingles up the spine moment. You sort of see the, you know, the fruits of like a whole year's work. You know, it's not just, you know, so everyone in the team, you know, that's, we normally have a bit of a group hug at that point, don't we?
So we let you off lightly. We were talking about incidents on the scale of 1 to 10. You gave us the blowing of a light bulb. Nush, that's not good enough.
Not
we're going to finish strongly here. What would be a 10?
One time, not at Green Man, at another festival. We were rushing to get the site ready on sort of Friday lunchtime, and the site crew were like rushing to get the last of the toilets out and picked up a toilet in a forklift truck, drove it across site, put it down, at which point the occupant walks out of the toilet.
You're listening to Culture on Monocle 24, and we're doing a roundup of 2016. Now, this year, it's been difficult to have a conversation that doesn't somehow end up being about Trump or Brexit. Politics has managed to seep its way into the programme too. As Donald Trump was announced as the new leader of the free world, we put out a show all about protest songs and music's role in revolutions. Here is Dorian Lynskey on protest songs in 2016.
A lot of protest songs are not suitable to be used in protest, you know, like Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit. This is not something that you can sort of sing at a rally or a picket line. You know, there's a reason why people still sing We Shall Overcome, Give Peace a Chance, these very old songs, because they're designed for group singing. It's the way that it's really about the melody. It's not about the recorded version. You know, the best versions of those songs are probably the ones that people sing around the world. But what's been interesting is that some of the hip-hop songs, like Kendrick Lamar's All Right, have taken on a life as something that people can chant at Black Lives Matter protests. That's when it gets really exciting, that it's a great record, but it also has this other life.
And when I wake up, I recognize you looking at me for the pay cut. Bahamas, I be looking at you from the face down. One Mac 11, even boom with the bass down. Skimming, and let me tell you about my life. Painkillers only put me in a twilight. Where pretty pussy and Benjamin is the highlight. I tell my mama I love her, but this what I like. Lord knows, 20 of them in my Chevy.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing, and I wonder, so much hip-hop is... to use the word strangely maybe, but you know, is literate and is about things. It is not pure pop music. It obviously comes from somewhere. It was the underground music of the mid-80s and 90s. Do you think it's come into its own? Do you think it has broken across borders as something that is meaningful for the first time since NWA and Public Enemy in this US election?
I mean, there have been periods of time when it's been more meaningful. There were quite a few hip-hop protest songs around Hurricane Katrina and George Bush in general. But there's something about the rise of Trump parallel to the rise of Black Lives Matter. And that those two things, there's something to believe in and there's also somebody to oppose. And that's brought a lot of MCs who are not necessarily associated with politics. I think, you know, you've got a certain camp where it might be Kendrick Lamar or Public Enemy back in the day, where their modus operandi is fairly political. And then you've got people who, like T.I., or YG, two rappers that have put out anti-Trump protest songs this year. And that's not their brand, in a sense. And I think there's always something quite exciting about people that are often not addressing politics. And that's always been the case inside and outside of hip-hop. There's a special energy, you know, that you had with Marvin Gaye and What's Going On. He'd never been political before. So when he was political, it was a big deal. When James Brown did Say It Loud and Black and I'm Proud, it was a big deal because it hadn't happened before. It wasn't sort of the usual suspect. Picket lines, and picket signs, don't punish me
with brutality. Talk to me. And these protest songs, you mentioned Marvin Gaye and James Brown, when they came out, when they made political songs, made political statements within those songs, that was not without its complication, obviously for the record companies involved, for even their band members, even for playing those songs live, presumably. Does now in 2016, rappers like YG, who are maybe you wouldn't have thought of, as you said, as political stars making political records, what does that do, I wonder, to their regular fan base? I wonder if they find it enfranchising. Now I'm asking you to step into their world and imagine it a bit. But I wonder if you feel that is an enfranchising thing, or they go, "Oh, I preferred it when they were, you know, I preferred it when it was more pure pop or more. It was about different stuff."
Well, I think they move with the audience. I mean, even though, you know, black people were being killed by the police every year, you know, something about Black Lives Matter that's made it so present and so current. You know, the threat. Something about Trump that is just, I mean, you can't really sort of escape him and escape the anxiety around this election. So I think their fans are pretty excited to hear the occasional protest song. It's not like these people have, it's not like What's Going On, where Marvin Gaye, for one album, and really one album only, reinvented himself as a fully political religious artist. These are kind of one-off songs. They're very impactful. There's a series called 30 Songs in 30 Days that Shepherd Fairey has been involved with.
Yeah.
Getting a lot of different artists to do protest songs. Not so much hip-hop, but all kinds of artists. The people who've never done them before, like Franz Ferdinand, Amy Mann, you know. And there's something about this year that makes that seem like audiences are up for that, even if they're not particularly political. I don't think anybody's going to object. It's not the same as kind of completely reinventing yourself and going, right, I'm only going to do, you know, no more party songs.
I wonder whether, like, a good love song should encapsulate the weird and wonderful feeling that you have when you're in love. A protest song should be able to encapsulate one's frustration and hopes and dreams, I suppose, and great frustrations with more wit and wisdom and with great melody, or a memorable one at least. Is that the bedrock of what the protest song is, in a way? And when you know, as you said, this great 30 Songs in 30 Days project, things like this come out, that's what it does. It kind of allows people to be enfranchised in a pretty simple way by reflecting themselves back at them.
Well, I think it's a basic human need. You know, you can say that this sort of, you know, the job of art is to make you feel less alone. That can be a song or it can be a novel. It is empowering and sort of consoling for people to hear their thoughts and their anxieties mirrored. That's why certain clips of you know, TV presenters or talk radio hosts doing these fiery monologues, it's why they go viral, because people are like, great, somebody else is saying that on a public stage. And it's the same with songs. And, you know, YG's song, it's just called Fuck Donald Trump. And it really could not be more direct. I mean, the lyrics are a bit cleverer than that, But that's wonderful because it's so direct.
Express it in three words that aren't "I love you."
Yeah.
Was the challenge and you came up with "fuck Donald Trump."
It's just like it is a pure expression of frustration, and there's actually quite a lot of sort of wit and detail in the verses. But people crave that, and the argument that I've always made about protest music is that the audience, you need the audience, you need the listeners. You can't sort of criticize artists for not speaking out when the general climate of the culture, you know, which has happened at various times, sort of mid-90s when everything seemed relatively comfortable, you know, and I don't think people were craving political music and therefore most artists weren't delivering it. And it's exciting when you can see these artists thinking, well, this is what I'm feeling, and it's also what a lot of listeners are feeling. And then there's a sort of cathartic bonding.
No, we can't be a slave for him. He got me appreciating Obama way more. Hey, Donald, and everyone that follows, you gave us your reason to be president, but we hate so Donald Trump.
Dorian Lynskey there speaking to me about protest songs. Our favourite appearance of Donald Trump on Culture this year was when he was in piñata form for a short film called La Madre Buena. Film director Sarah Clift came in to tell Holly all about it.
I think what I really enjoyed was using the Mexican children as a picture of innocence, you know. So as we hear, you know, Donald Trump talking about Mexican citizens being rapists and murderers and all those things, just having those in the back of your mind when you sing these beautiful, innocent kids, you know, and that's where every Mexican child starts at. And so if anyone was going to bash Donald Trump, I think, you know, it was deserved of an 8-year-old, innocent, well-behaved boy.
Sarah Clift was a good value guest, and that was a great little vignette of what Trump's election or potential election meant for people all over the world, and particularly these people. Where did you find out about that one, Holly?
I found out about this film because somebody who has been a guest on the show before did the music direction for it. So she...
This is part of Holly's intelligence network. I like this. Yeah.
She put it on my radar, and I think I've watched it. It's only 5 minutes long. I've watched it about 22 times.
You have. I think this is a kind of like a leitmotif.
It's been around the whole office three
times.
It's
been down the pub. It's been essentially your screensaver on your phone for quite a while.
Yeah, it's just got some very glorious shots of a woman who very clearly doesn't like Donald Trump. I don't think she's alone there. On a motorbike going through the Mexican countryside with enormous paper mache Donald Trump behind her. And it's just, there's a very beautiful shot. And it's about a mother battling with her politics and parenthood to decide whether she should get this piñata for her son's birthday. And a very nice scene at the end that Sarah talks about in that clip, where these kids are at the party smashing Donald Trump in the face with a big stick.
It's pretty good stuff. There is both catharsis and surrealism in equal measure in this small film, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, let's talk about books now. We've got to squeeze it all in. We've had plenty to talk about in the publishing world in 2016, as ever. This was the year that saw a boom in translated fiction. We invited Anne Meadows from Granter and the literary agent Lisette Verhagen in to discuss why we're all so thirsty for foreign books.
For a while, fiction in translation was marketed as though it was going to be very serious and good for you.
Yeah.
And it was going to educate you, and it was going to maybe...
That's right. There's a bit of fear factor about how serious it might be.
Yeah, right? It seemed kind of snobby or for the elite, which again is totally ridiculous. And I think the last 10 years, there have been so many success stories of books like Haruki Murakami is just fun to read. His novels are wonderful.
And presumably all the Henning Mankell books. There's so many things that are humongously popular just happen that they're written in Swedish or Japanese, exactly.
Precisely. Right?
Another trend in book publishing has been nature. It seems we're all desperate to get back in touch with the natural world, as the writer Melissa Harrison explained during a muddy walk with Holly in South London.
I feel like, and I think, you know, this is a movement among a lot of writers at the moment, that we're losing a sense of particularity about landscape. We're losing the sense of what things are and what they feel like and therefore what they mean to us. And that loss of connection is a loss to us, and it's also a loss in terms of our ability to save places and things. A lot of the people that I know are part of the last generation to play outside unsupervised. You know, I went out in the morning and played in the woods and fields by myself or with friends and came home when I was hungry, and that, you know, the world has changed so much. And I wonder if this is that generation looking around and going, my God, what have we lost?
And over now to the behemoth of all book fairs, the Hay Festival. Founder Peter Florence told us where he'd like to take the next annual literary extravaganza.
My dream is Hay Festival Tehran. You know, the great literary capital of the last 2,000 years. An extraordinary special place that is changing with incredible speed and has always been a city of the book.
Okay, Holly, a brace of things there from the Fisher Canon from 2016. How muddy was your muddy walk in South London with Melissa?
Fairly muddy.
Yeah.
Were
you appropriately shod?
Yes, I was warned to wear wellies before I went, so sick. I was well equipped. Okay. Yeah, but it was nice. We were walking her dog, Scout.
There was a lot of good sound ups in that.
Yeah,
in that piece of audio, I remember.
Yeah,
well.
Lots of birds tweeting and a lot of trains going past as well. But that was a lot of fun. We were talking about her book, which is all about rain, and it was a suitably rainy day. So,
yeah. Okay.
What better time?
Well, yeah, anyone can be an expert in that when you live in England anywhere, presumably, right? Or that corner of it.
I think so, but she is
especially
knowledgeable on the subject.
Okay. You were going to say she's especially wet, and then you thought better of it. And you thought, Rob will probably say that. It'll be fine. Let's change the subject and talk about the Hay Festival. We've got a couple of seconds to talk about Hay. I've never been. Is it as monstrous and as joyous as people say?
It's a lot of fun. Yeah. I was only there for two nights, I think. Yeah, it was great.
You had a really good party and you can't remember it, can you?
Yeah, something like that. I remember there being a sort of weird moment in a dancing in a bookshop with Benedict Cumberbatch or something, which is...
Sounds definitely like a limerick, like the beginning of what might be a dirty limerick. if anyone's got suggestions on how to end that, please write into hf@monocle.com. Shall we remind our listeners of our Culture Live programme that we did, Holly?
Yes, that was fun,
right?
Yeah. It was fun. It was fun and... stressful in equal measures, I would say. I think I had a lot of dreams leading up to this where we were driving around in taxis and not getting to the venue on time.
No.
But it was fine. It all paid off in the end. It was perfect.
And we had three great guests. We had Nicholas Kenyon from the Barbican. We had Will Hodgkinson. Good old Hodge.
We had four great guests.
Did we? Oh, of course we did. Come on, you do the other two. Come on, Victoria.
We had Victoria Siddle and we had Jordan Gross, founder of Ovalspace. Over in Bethnal Green, yes.
And they were all quite good, all from different corners of the arts, sort of, but everyone kind of got on. I didn't really need to be there.
No.
Which is a sign of a good discussion, right?
You were a great host and I think you anchored it well.
I think it's very challenging. And when we started 4 years ago, it was challenging then as well. And you're really talking about, and we started off with a warehouse and just saying, hey, we're going to just take a warehouse, have a half drain pipe for a toilet and make a bit of a go of it. And over the last few years, it's evolved into a fully fledged venue that we use for a whole range of cultural activities, including music.
The drain pipe is now for sale. It's a rent.
Yeah, it's now for sale. Yeah. You can buy that on eBay later.
Beautiful.
So I think it's very, very hard. And it's really a question, two questions really. One is about rents in the city. And other cities have rent control, like Berlin and Paris, where they really protect these kind of institutions. And the other aspect is about licensing. And actually, our experience with licensing has actually always been a very positive one, I have to say. And the police, when we were getting our license, and even now, are very, very constructive and have always been very, very helpful to us. But I think that's also about being professional operators as well. And although I was new to this business entirely when we started, it was always gone about in a scenario where we wanted to be very professional and we wanted to be as good an operator as we possibly could be. So for us, I actually find that sort of thing's quite relatively easy, I would say. And I think that London can be a very welcoming place from that side of things, but you have to behave yourself and you have to know what the right things to do are.
People have a funny idea maybe of nightlife, that it's a sort of lascivious thing or something, rather than actually it's a huge part of the economy. London is going to elect a nightmare. Insert your own joke. Is it going to?
I think he's being appointed, right?
He's going.
There are people applying now. Yeah.
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 Who's going to apply? Is anyone here going to apply to be the nightmare? Well,
No, I'm. The hours aren't very good.
Exactly. Technically, I should be asleep right now.
We love, but Amsterdam, to give one example, has an absolutely brilliant nightmare who is curating that part of the city's existence really effectively.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you know, hang on, let's face it, we've only just got a night tube, so maybe we've got time to develop this, but it is an absolutely key part of what's going to make London happen and keep happening in the future.
That's the thing, right? I wonder if we've got a night tube, but we don't have anywhere to go.
I mean, that's. I mean, if
or we're, come back from.
If we're not, careful, we're going to end up at the M4 corridor.
The M4 corridor.
Yeah, absolutely.
Would you like to? I wonder if Jordan would like to single out some towns along the M4
no,
corridor.
No, not particularly. That. Doesn't I've want been to specifically prohibited from singling out Slough or Reading. Sorry.
To say it. Okay. I've got one last question. If London has a problem and a fix, I wonder if there's anything, Jordan, that you see. We've talked about nightlife and the rest of it. It might be something very specific and tiny, or it might be something huge in general. But we want to kind of leave our listeners and our guests with an idea of being able to fix any problems that London has. So if London has a problem, what is it and how might you fix it?
Well, I think an easy thing would be to realise that nightlife, things that happen, you know, after 8 p.m., after midnight, is a really important part of our culture that we need to all support and recognise in that context. And recently, Bergheim in Berlin was recognised as high culture.
This is a big mega club. I don't know if everyone knows Bergheim.
Well, yeah. A very famous techno club in Germany that's responsible for a lot of the music that we do here in London. Recently recognised actually in the tax courts as being high culture, essentially, which is quite amazing. Made some quite nice headlines over there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and so we can learn from Berlin a little.
We can learn from that and just put it in that frame.
Victoria,
The mayor's office did a study here last year and found that they predict that 30% of artist studios in this city will disappear within the next 5 years, which is a pretty terrifying statistic. 5 years is a very short amount of time. There are a lot of artists living and working in London. And that's what makes it interesting. You know, who wants to live in a city without artists?
And it's difficult to sell art if you don't make it in the city, because it's part
exactly.
It's part of the attraction of.
And
Fries.
They'll all go to Berlin.
Yeah, so, or Leipzig.
Yeah, right. or somewhere else. Yeah. And so they have started an initiative to protect artist studio space in London. But it's essential that that happens quickly, because otherwise they will just be all creatives and artists will just be priced out of London, which would be a tragedy.
Yeah, so creative is not the same as an artist.
Yeah, right. Creators make more money.
Nick, what do you see as a problem? How might you fix it?
Well, coming out of what we were just talking about, I think what's missing is connection between the planning process, housing, and the cultural infrastructure. I think there's a fantastic opportunity now. You only have to go to King's Cross and see how Granary Square has enlivened that area and how really intelligent development by an intelligent developer can improve the public realm for everybody. I would like to see constructed connections, open spaces, public realms between our cultural venues so that those things can be joined up as an experience.
Will, what do you...
I would.
Everyone's nodding along, by the way. I should tell our radio listeners. Everyone's nodding along to each other's answers here, which is a good thing. What's the... If you had a problem and nobody else can help, and it wasn't the A-team, how would you fix a problem?
I'd develop on Nick's point, and I would say that in my, you know, my world of sort of bands and artists and everything, people need rehearsal spaces. Yeah. That's a big problem because rehearsal spaces are disappearing because they are seen as taking up a lot of space. I would say that they deserve a certain degree of protection in the same way that venues are now beginning to be understood to deserve a, you know, so for example, the 100 Club was saved, it was going to be closed down, you know, so I'd say you need rehearsal space. It's just a financial question, isn't it? You know, when London's too expensive, you're not going to be, you know, when people can't afford to live here, musicians, artists aren't the kind of people that, especially when starting out, are going to be able to afford it. But on the other hand, people are incredibly resilient and they'll, you know, be four to a room if they have to be. But they can't, they have to be able to rehearse and they have to have access to things. Even if it's electronic music, you still need to have access. So I would say that's the key.
Shall we talk about the lovely Lavinia Nixon? And by the way, we should tell our listeners, I'm sure there'll be another Culture Live happening at Midori House or somewhere around the world. Who knows where our plane or train or automobile might take us, Holly. So they should check out monocle.com, right, for some advertisement
definitely.
Of that. And we'll think of a question. Holly will find some amazing guests and I will probably look quite hot. In a physically warm way on stage only.
Maybe in both ways.
Maybe in both ways, who knows. What about Lavinia Nixon?
Yeah, she was good. So Lavinia Nixon is an Australian TV presenter and she popped
up. She's a bit
of
a ledge, isn't she? She's a weather forecaster.
Yeah, she's a weather forecaster. So she popped up in our show about weather forecasting, funnily enough. And our correspondent over in Melbourne, Adrian Craddock, went over and met her to find out how you present the weather.
Lavinia's back with the weather. Warming up again, Lavinia.
That's right, Pete. Today was the one mild day this week. Heat is building over South Australia again. Adelaide is likely to break its record of 11 days over 40 in summer. Tomorrow will actually be good here, but dangerously hot weather isn't far away. I'll have the details next. I think you need to be able to speak very clearly, as everyone on television needs to. I think you need to be able to take a lot of very complicated information and put it into layman's terms. And I think you need to have an accessible presence to you. It's such an honour to be in people's living rooms every night. And, you know, they're letting you into their space, into their home, into their time with their family. So I think you need to be very respectful of that and just do the best job that you can do.
So can you walk me through your typical day? How does it work for you?
We have a producer who comes in and she starts working on the scripts, just giving the actual scripts some bones, because obviously as the day unfolds, temperatures are changing and winds are shifting, so that alters the script. We have the forecast that comes in at 20 past four. So once that arrives, we go light the clappers and we're busily updating everything. We're on air at 4:40. Then with the national updates, then we do it again at 5:15. Then we do a 5:45 hit. Then we're on for the Melbourne news at 6:15, 6:10, and 7:08. So all up, there's about 7.5 minutes of weather. So that's a lot of script writing, that's a lot of graphics, and it's a lot of checking, double checking. For example, a couple of nights ago, the maximum didn't come in till 5:45. So you've really got to stay on top of things and not just assume that it's done, because by its very nature, it's an ever-changing beast. So you really just have to keep an eye on everything and dot your I's and cross your T's.
And I've read that you have a challenge that other presenters don't have. At the end of your report, you have to kind of silently go up to the desk and sit down before the report is finished. Can you explain what that's about and how that works?
So for 95% of the weather report, I'm standing in front of the plasma TV talking to people about the weather. Then we go to a full frame graphic, which means all you're seeing is that graphic. And then the next shot of me is I'm sitting next to Pete saying, "Rug up tonight, Pete," or whatever the throw is. So we write it. So there's about 9 seconds where I have to keep talking and moving to the chair. It's really not that big a deal. People can talk and walk at the same time. It always seems to fascinate people how that happens, but it's really not that big a deal.
Am I not the first person to ask you about this?
No, you are not the first person to ask me about that. How do you get there to that chair? I'm like, I walk and talk.
But aren't there times where things don't go to plan? I mean, we were saying it's live television. I mean, you know, you can trip during that time. You can get to the desk and there's no chair. Has that ever happened before?
Yes, I've got to the desk before and there was no chair there, so I was doing leg squats. But yeah, they're not much fun, those instances. There have also been times when I wear two microphones every night, one as the main one and one as backup, and both those microphones have gone down. So with 15 seconds to go, I was standing there with four people around me trying to put on a microphone that worked with the back of my dress unzipped down to my waist, and I'm standing there and they're saying 10 seconds. I'm like, okay, breathe. You know, that's really quite stressful. I've had moments when my three-year-old Ted was in the studio and I had 10 seconds to go and he ran up and jumped into my arms and said, "Mummy, I need to go to the toilet." And I went, oh, well, this is interesting, isn't it? My worlds are colliding. So one of the gorgeous girls who works with us had to whisk him away to the bathroom with all of 5 seconds to go. So, yes, live TV definitely keeps you on your toes.
That seems to be the real magic. It seems to be keeping this veneer of calmness and keeping it all together while in reality things are going crazy behind the scenes. Is that a kind of a fair assessment?
Well, I think everyone has those moments at work where you're trying to make it look calm and collected. And, you know, that's our job. Our job is to present the news as best we can. It's not for people at home to say, oh, well, you know, they tried their best. You know, oh, we'll forgive them that. You know, they went to the wrong story. And, you know, that wears very thin very quickly. So, you know, we have an incredibly talented, polished team and we thank goodness, touch wood, I'm probably going to moz us, very rarely make mistakes. So, yeah, we give it our best shot every night.
Holly, it's time for one of our auction stories. We've done a couple this year. We went to the Four Seasons sale, which was the Four Seasons restaurant in New York. That was a great piece of audio.
Mm.
That was really nice. But let's focus on this unusual one where they sold the contents of the Emmen Zoo.
Yeah, this was
Holland.
A good one.
This is deeply strange, right? So do you remember James Rylands? He was an auctioneer. He's a director at Summer's Place down in Billingshurst in God's Own County of Sussex, of course. And this is well worth a visit, this place on its own, because it's a Victorian mansion. And it's got 7 acres of gardens brimming with all sorts of strange statuary ornamentation, things they might not have sold, possibly, you think. But it's a great place just to visit. Anyway, Emmen Zoo in the Netherlands was selling their natural history collection after relocating to the other side of that city. This comprised various fossils, drawings ranging from small immortalized fish to an extraordinarily awesome 7-metre-tall, near-complete dinosaur skeleton. So this is James, and he's speaking with Monocle's Jolien Goffin at the auction house.
It's actually been a bit tricky valuing some of these pieces, and Rupert Narrell have been more involved in that. But there are a number of pieces where there's no comparable object ever sold at auction before. But since the Emmen Museum can't have any of the items back, we've actually had a policy of saying, right, well, we are, apart from the dinosaur, we're going to offer it all without reserve with really quite modest estimates and then just see where the market goes. So that should engender some quite competitive bidding today.
Because, I mean, not that I find it cheap, but I have to say, I would have expected for a dinosaur, such an exceptional collector's item, a lot more money, though.
It's a tricky one. I mean, you know, I think the most expensive we sold one for £500,000, which is a bit bigger than this, a few years ago, and that went to the Danish Natural History Museum. That was Diplodocus. The estimate, hopefully, is modest, but the other thing I think we have to remember is you can't fit it into everybody's home. And it's one of those instances where, you know, I'd like to say, well, every home should have one, but you sure as hell can't fit that into every home. So that's actually a bit of a guiding thing as well.
And I wonder, how do you maintain a dinosaur? How do you dust it?
Listen, it's been like that for quite a long time, since it was excavated. They don't require, you know, oiling, polishing or anything like that. And they also don't require feeding. So...
So what happens after the purchase? So you slam the hammer, then what?
So after the fall of the hammer, obviously the bidders in the room or on the internet or thing, they're allocated a paddle number, which is a number unique to them, which relates to their personal details that we have already. And then they will be sent a bill, sadly, that's the reality. And then... once payment arrives, then they'll either come and pick it up, or we will quite often, we spend a lot of time organising shipping to all over the world, and so we use a number of different carriers. So then it becomes a logistics exercise, if you like. And I think it's fair to say that we probably spend more time organising shipping than anything else, because this stuff does go all over the world. We get these things in for sale, we catalogue them, we research them, we sell them, and then they all go. It's sort of like, you know, and you're left sort of orphaned almost. We love seeing things in their new locations, and we don't actually often have the opportunity to do that. You know, so once they're gone, and it's like sort of birds flying a nest, really.
Okay, Holly, to end the show, this is an appropriate end, I think. I think this is something that maybe not the both of us, but certainly I feel I was destined to do, be a quiz show host. Come on, there's no...
You're certainly wearing the jacket for it.
I am tonight. I know, it's gone a bit showbiz in here, in Studio 2 this evening, isn't it? So this is when we had John Mitchinson, who our listeners will probably know as he's a publisher and he's a great critic of books, and he comes in and he talks very passionately about books. He also happens to be one of the people that came up with the quiz show QI, which is huge in the UK, and I think it's been exported to other parts of the world as well. And Mark Mason, who's a question setter, who's a writer, who's a sort of quiz aficionado. These two men knew each other. I think they had a kind of friendly rivalry with each other, at least in the quizzing realm, right? Didn't they?
It was a healthy rivalry.
Okay, that's okay, good. Well, should we let this one run? So this is Mark Mason and John Mitchinson, and this was our very own culture show quiz.
Hey,
Okay, and this is the Culture Show Quiz Show, and I'm your host, Robert Bound. Our contestants today are Mark Mason and John Mitchinson, and they'll be battling it out for our top prize, a much-coveted bag of chocolate coins.
Woo!
Okay, you both have a ready-made selection of buzzers in front of you. John, would you like to choose your buzzer noise first? Very nice. A depth charge sort of warning there. Mark, what's going to be your buzzer? Very nice. A coily spring. Slightly... What?
No, I just want to make it again.
It's pretty good news, isn't it? Okay, our question one. You both ready? Fingers on the buzzers? Our first question today was the first correctly answered jackpot winner of popular TV show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire when Judith Keppel took the top prize back in the year 2000. The question is, who was married to Eleanor of Aquitaine? And this is a multiple choice quiz. Multiple choice quiz, Mark. Don't jump the gun there. Don't jump the coil. Was it A, Henry I? B, Henry II, C, Richard I, or D, Henry V? I think Mark Mason got in there first.
I know it was the second one you said, which I've now forgotten, but it was the second one.
It was answer B, Henry II. Was that going to be your answer, John?
I was going to say Henry I.
It was Henry II.
Oh.
I do have the answers, yeah.
I remember her winning it, and I remember the answer.
Yeah.
But you know, that's so how that's bad my memory is. So I can remember that, and that would have been the late 90s.
Yeah.
So I could remember, but then within the 3 seconds of you saying it, I actually forgot what it was, but I knew it was the second one.
Henri Deux was Eleanor of Aquitaine. So we're already thinking of ways to remember it, right? Yeah. Question two, this is trivia. The next two questions are popular pub quiz questions. Mark, this is your territory. Which five underground stations, London Underground Station, have the word town in their name?
Go on, you can do
it. Okay, well, I'm going to try and work it out as I go. Okay. Acton Town, Sudbury Town, and how many do I need
five,
to get?
You
need all five. And there is, you see, that's I've written a book on the tube and I'm
Canning
used to
songs.
Canning Town.
Very good,
good,
John.
There's
two very obvious ones I'd have thought here that we haven't said. We've got Sudbury, we've got Acton, and we've got Canning. Two towns. Let's go to North London.
Ooh.
I've only had a sand of time. Yeah, not very far from Hampstead.
Kentish Town and
Camden Town.
Oh, I think we have to split them.
I was in a pub quiz the other night and a Coutube question
that's
came
a good
up.
Question.
And someone
a good question.
Got it before
that's a good question. We got all the hard ones. See, that's the problem.
We're too good.
All right, question three. This is a history question. Seeing as we're approaching the end of the year, we thought we'd throw in a festive one. During which years was Christmas banned in England? John Mitchinson.
It was banned during the Commonwealth, which was, I think, started in about 1646.
No, it was 1646.
Definitely, you're right there, it was 1647.
47, yeah. And then the rest, when it was reinstated, the restoration, which was...
1660.
That's
good. You see, you're working rather annoyingly for our listeners and for the needle. You're working collectively here.
Oh,
it's very good.
Dear,
it was indeed 1647, 1660. Yeah. Due to Oliver Cromwell, the ban on Christmas was brought about by the rise of Christian Puritans such as Cromwell. The Christian Puritans believed that there was
they
no biblical evidence.
They banned mince pies as well.
But also, bizarrely, Cromwell, seen as the big Puritan who banned everything, liked football and was disliked by the other Puritans because they all wanted to ban football and he liked football.
They also banned Lent. they banned the Lenten
giving
fast.
Things up, right? Yes,
yeah, because exactly. They thought it was sort of idolatrous. You know, it's like eating too much was bad, but also eating too little was bad as well.
Okay. Those pesky Cromwellians. Yeah. Okay. Question four. This is a quiz-related question. Name all three presenters of the British game show Blankety Blank. And for a bonus point, who will be presenting the Christmas special this year?
Les Dawson.
Yes.
Terry Wogan.
Two.
Oh, was it Les Dennis? Did he do it? No.
Did Dale Winton do it?
No. We are in the... it was done by someone's alter ego. A comedian's alter ego.
It wasn't Dame Edna.
No.
Lily Savage.
Mm, very good.
And will you get the bonus? Do you want to chuck a celebrity hat
blankety
in
blank.
The ring?
Not Graham Norton.
Not Graham Norton. Someone who you would have thought might do if Frankie Howard had done it, you might
Alan Carr.
It's David Walliams.
Oh, very good. But I have someone did point out recently, the British MP that's been in the news for various reasons, Keith Vaz. His wife is called Valerie. And when someone points out to you that the theme tune to Blankety Blank fits Valerie Vaz perfectly. Valerie Vaz. Valerie Vaz. Valerie Vaz. It stays in your head for the rest of the day, trust me.
Good spot about Alan Carr being the reincarnation of Frankie Howard. I'd never thought till this moment.
That's you're basically what it is.
Yeah. And our final question, question 5, is lifted directly from an episode of QI. So pressure's on, John.
No fresh.
Where are 1% of Americans? Buzzers, please, if you want to.
Oh, God. Oh, no.
It's going to be about 3 million people, then.
Where are 1% of Americans?
Is it something like on the loo at any given time? Is it?
We're thinking about a more specific place, actually.
Is it somewhere they've emigrated to?
No, not necessarily.
In the air at any given time? On aeroplanes at any given time?
You're in a similar place.
But it has to be a specific...
A specific place, a specific idea.
Somewhere unexpected, like Moscow, Russia, or...
if I was an uncharitable, I'd say you're getting warm.
Yeah.
Do you want me to...
It's about 3 million people. It's a place in America.
Where are 1% of Americans at any given time? Right now, as we speak, as we play this quiz, we're 1% of Americans.
And it's a country. Are you giving us not a country, but it's a in bed, having
prison.
Sex in prison.
Oh, my God, of course, yes.
Of God, yes.
Okay, so do you want to know the scores on the Doors, chaps?
Go on.
Mark won with 2.5 points, John. Yay! Trading only slightly behind on 2 points. Thank you very much indeed for playing the Culture Show Quiz Show. Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture.
My presenter was the host with the most, Bobby Monocle.
And my producer was the beloved Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time next week for our first show of 2017, when we'll be looking at the year ahead in films, books and music. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bounds.
I'm Holly Fisher.
And thanks for tuning in.